Warning, today's story is rated R for violence and some sexual innuendo, but mostly for political and moral themes that are complex and potentially very disturbing.
Escape Pod 58. June 15th, 2006. Today's story, Shadow Boxer, by Paul DeFilippo.
Hello, welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely. Let's talk about politics and science fiction. It's a subject that can't help but generate controversy when it appears. And often it's not even the ideas themselves, but simply the existence of politics in people's entertainment. There are some people who think polemics in fiction is a pointless distraction. The old quote, if you want to send a message, use Western Union. And there are others who think that fiction doesn't have any purpose at all unless it's holding a direct mirror up to our world. My personal feeling is that it's a false dichotomy. There are worldviews in every story, from the Foundation series to Goodnight Moon and Curious George. And just because the author doesn't say this is a political novel doesn't mean it isn't there. It is true that I'm not a fan of fiction that hammers people over the head with what to think. I find that an insult. I've got a lot of strong political opinions. It's hard to find people who don't these days, but I don't share them in my intros here. And yeah, part of it's just because it's off-topic and I'd piss off half of you no matter what I said. But a lot of it's because I don't have the gall. To stand up on a soapbox and tell people where to stand on issues implies that I have some knowledge or insight that other people don't have. And I don't. I believe what I believe, and I believe in my reasons for it, but I'm not willing to hold my beliefs up against yours and say, aha, you're wrong because you weren't thinking straight. The world's not that simple. So I don't think there's much place in science fiction for giving people the answers. That usually leads to pomposity and some very bad storytelling. Where I do think there's value, especially in short science fiction, is in asking the questions. Every change in the world creates new conflicts, new ideas, and new opportunities to extrapolate even more changes. And that's something SF does better than any other fiction. Better than nonfiction, even, because stories resonate better with the human mind than dry facts. We've all heard the phrase, failure of imagination, in the news these past few years. And if science fiction has any kind of real-world mission, it's to help make sure that imagination doesn't fail. It isn't necessary that every SF story challenge us and shake up our assumptions. But the ones that do, with good storytelling, are the ones that dig deep into us. The ones we carry with us all our lives. And that, to me at least, is a fitting segue into this week's story. We're proud to present Shadow Boxer by Paul DeFilippo. Mr. DeFilippo lives in Providence, Rhode Island. He's the author of 10 novels, almost a dozen short story collections, a regular feature in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, and lately a few comic book projects in the X-Men and Top 10 franchises. His upcoming novel is Creature from the Black Lagoon, due out in a couple of weeks from Dark Horse, kicking off a line of novels from top authors based on Universal's classic monster movies. This story was first published in Amazing in December of 2004. The story is read for us by Scott Fletcher of the Podcheck Review podcast. Scott's widely known as the golden voice of podcasting. Allegations that several podcasters have died from pure envy on hearing his voice have never been sustained in court. And in today's top headlines, it's story time.
Shadow Boxer by Paul DeFilippo. Generally speaking, I only need 3 minutes of concentrated attention to kill someone by staring at them. If I'm feeling under the weather or my mind is preoccupied with other matters, you know how your mind can obsess about trivial things sometimes. It might take 5 minutes for my power to have its effect. On the other hand, if I focus intensely on my victim, I can get the job done in as little as 90 seconds. Another factor determining the speediness of my power is the constitution of my victim. A As you might imagine, the elderly and the frail and ailing require less effort to kill than the hale and hearty and young. But no one is immune from my gaze, at least no one that I've yet encountered. And I've encountered plenty. Now the nation is at war, or so we're told. I guess that changes everything. A person like me becomes much more important. Sometimes I feel like I've always lived in these few rooms, but I know I've been penned up here for only a couple of years. Still, that's a long time to go without seeing another person, even for a loner like me. It's a wonder I'm still sane, if indeed I am. The first time I got photos of kids as part of my killing assignment, I staged a strike for 3 days. Wouldn't use my power at all. There was no punishment meted upon me by my unseen employers, no diminishment of my limited perks. I couldn't figure out what they intended, or how they hoped to coerce me. But then, on the fourth day, the media did their job for them. I read in U.S. News and World Report about a bus bombing in Israel. 13 people killed and dozens wounded. The bomber had been a teenage girl. Her photo had been in the pile. When they resubmitted the photos of the kids, minus the girls, I went straight to work on them. I call all the different guys who speak to me over the intercom connecting me with the outside world, Dave. Occasionally a woman's on duty, and I call her Dave too. She's fractionally nicer than the guys, in some indefinable sense, but still pretty blank. They refuse to tell me their real names, of course, or even supply a friendly alias, so this is my countermeasure. I reduce them all to the same individual. They're just following orders, I know, when they withhold their names, but still, you think they'd have some human feeling for their prisoner. I'm helping them, after all, aren't I? Doing good for my country? I suppose everyone's nervous about me taking some kind of revenge against my captors, whose real name was revealed, if I ever escape. But they don't have to worry about that. I haven't really killed anyone for personal reasons since I became a professional assassin. Killing someone with an emotional or personal connection to me was a sure way to get caught eventually, I believed. Therefore, I've learned to rein in my natural emotional reactions to insults and slights and aggression. As an adult, committing murder with my peculiar talent meant money, not revenge. Now they tell me my lethal actions meant the survival of Western civilization. Killing randomly or for personal reasons would have violated my code of survival. Having a code is important to me. Sometimes I think about my parents. I was an only child, but they didn't dote on me. I was just an accepted part of the household furnishings, like the couch or the television. They weren't mean to me, just indifferent. Maybe that treatment had something to do with how I am today. Still, I never bore them any ill will, certainly never thought once about using my power on them. They're still alive and well, as far as I know. I don't know where my current living quarters are located. Once I was kidnapped by a squad of rough men in my darkened bedroom, I couldn't see a thing. I was brought here drugged into unconsciousness. The place is a suite of 5 rooms, not Spartan, not luxurious, but rather like the rooms in a decent chain hotel. There are no windows, naturally. Something about the atmosphere, the tasteless processed air, leads me to believe that I'm deep underground, in some government bunker. The perfect silence contributes to that impression as well. Although, for all I know, I could be on the 15th floor of some urban tower, immured by yards of soundproofing, or in a cabin in the middle of a federal wilderness area, or in an abandoned oil platform out at sea. I have a very nice bedroom, a living room, an exercise room, and a kitchen and a game room. The furniture is all quite comfortable. Oh, and of course, a quite satisfactory bathroom. I guess that makes 6 rooms, but I don't think that the bathroom is conventionally counted in real estate descriptions. The living room contains a TV, but the set receives no broadcast or cable channels. I can use it only with the attached DVD player or Xbox. I have a computer, but no internet connection. I'm using that machine to keep this journal. The game room features a dartboard and a ping pong table. Being alone, I don't get much use out of the table tennis setup, but I've gotten pretty damn good with the darts. The whole place, I'm certain, is wired to the max. Cameras and microphones record my every action around the clock. The tapes must be excruciatingly boring for any Dave delegated to monitor them. When I'm not performing my assigned killings, all I do is lounge around, trying to keep myself moderately entertained. I cook most of my own meals, using the kitchen and the supplies delivered while I'm locked in my bedroom at specific times. The intercom orders me to retreat to the bedroom, and the door is locked by a remote control, a solenoid thunking the bolt home. I've never tried to see what would happen if I disobeyed. I can order out if I want. The franchise pizza and fried chicken and tacos arrive hot and fresh, which I suppose eliminates the possibility that I'm held out in some remote area. Unless, of course, they've gone through the trouble to duplicate the kitchens and staffs of those fast food joints right outside my door so as to conceal the clues to my real whereabouts from me. I wouldn't put that past them. All I have to do to get these meals is politely ask over the intercom that connects me with the unseen captors. I can't conduct frivolous conversations over that channel, but the Daves will attend to my legitimate requests. They'll provide me with books and magazines, too. No newspapers, though. The photos in the newspapers are often too recent and could be dangerous. Of course you wonder about sex. I'm a normal guy in my early 30s, so I have usual urges. I jerk off a lot in the dark. Maybe they've got infrared capabilities in their cameras and see me. So what? I'm only human after all. The way I was found out was this. Van Tran told me to do a job for a politician. Then news of my existence filtered into government circles and my abduction was practically guaranteed. I would still be free if only criminals knew about me. My power manifested itself for the first time when I entered puberty. Just like Carrie, right? I was a wimpy little kid, always getting picked on. Bullies seemed to gravitate towards me, happy and eager to punch the shit out of me. I never did anything to deserve their ire, except for existing. Just like I never did anything special to gain my power. In both cases, it's just the fluky way the universe works. I understand and accept that completely. So the year I was 13, the particular bane of my school day existence was this porky six-footer named Tony Grasso. Tony had been held back more than once and now stood out among the rest of his classmates like Andre the Giant among a reunion of Munchkin actors. The day I killed Tony, he had cornered me in the lavatory and given my head a thorough rinsing in the toilet before laughingly departing with my new calculator in his pocket. I didn't mind the dunking as much as I resented the loss of my calculator to such an oaf, especially since I was certain Tony would probably be unable to even find the on switch. After I cleaned myself up as best I could, I went to my next class, and there was Tony, leering at me and silently challenging me to rat him out. But of course I did no such thing. Instead, I took a seat as far away from him as I could, intending to focus on the class and enjoy the teaching. The class was math, and I liked it a lot, but I found myself unable to concentrate on the teacher's presentation. I couldn't take my eyes off Tony's hateful profile. Seeing my victim as in profile, I later learned, was not as effective as seeing them full face. And in my raging mind, I couldn't help picturing him dying in 100 different ways. I pictured Tony torn apart by wolves. I pictured him struck by cars. I pictured him impaled on the spiked fence that surrounded the local library. I pictured him writhing from poison, and so on. I'd always had a good imagination, and all these things were as vivid and as real as my powerful imagination could make them. In fact, I felt as if I was actually witnessing Tony's multiple deaths, not just daydreaming them, as if the scenes were playing out before my eyes. Anyway, after about 5 minutes of this morbid reverie, I saw Tony keel over on his desk without making a sound, except for the thump of his head, before bonelessly sliding to the floor. Girls shrieked, boys jumped up, and the teacher dashed out for help. But there was nothing anyone could do. Tony was quite dead. His autopsy revealed a fatal congenital heart defect, but one that no prior exam had ever discovered. For a while, I believed that whole gruesome affair was sheer coincidence. My imagining Tony dead could have had nothing to do with his actual death, but it took only a few more experiments to prove my own satisfaction that I had killed Tony. Of course, I'd made sure that those subsequent victims were not my fellow classmates. Even at age 13, I knew that a rash of deaths among my peers would have alerted even the most skeptical investigator. Bums and strangers, clerks, a nanny in the park, and a policeman or two, they all got congenital heart defects from me, or fatal aneurysms. I couldn't predict which defect would arise from my evil eye, but it was always one or the other. Did I say my apartment has no mirrors or other reflective surfaces in it? The question of who exactly my captors represent offers me endless material for speculation. The nature of all my victims since coming here convinces me that my talents are currently being employed by the government of the United States of America. But which agency? The CIA? The FBI? The NSA? Homeland Security? Or some even more covert set of initials? Maybe I'm under the jurisdiction of some branch of the military. Am I an honorary Marine or SEAL by now? Will I be freed with medals and a letter of commendation once the war on terror is over? And when exactly will that day come? Does the president know about me? Or am I some special project overseen by some unelected bureaucrat to maintain ultimate deniability higher up the chain of command? Which black budget contains the minimal expenses connected with my upkeep? Am I listed as general maintenance on some anonymous submarine? Or perhaps as a box of $600 hammers? I don't suppose I'll ever find out. More intriguingly, I spend a lot of time asking myself whether I agree with the uses to which my talents are being put. It might very well be that, for the first time in my adult life, I'm actually performing some selfless acts in helping with the preservation of my nation. Would I have volunteered for such duties had I been approached openly? Or would I have disdained any such exercise of my powers in support of national interests, in favor of my pampered life I once led? Again, it's hard to answer such a hypothetical question. I can only confront and judge my actions as they currently exist, under the current conditions. Most days I find them actually a trifle proud of what I'm doing. Although sometimes I sink into a kind of a numb apathy at the unvarying nature of my kills. Maybe this is just a rationalization I have to maintain in order to not hate myself. Discussing such matters with my captors might help, but this is not a luxury that I'm permitted. I think my talent is one that everyone imagines they would like to have. But believe me, it's not really that wonderful a gift. Van Tran was my boss from age 22 until I was taken by the government. He was an Asian criminal big shot. I met him at a funeral of some people I helped. I got into a conversation with him. He remarked about the uncanny way that some people connected with the funeral had died. He said how happy and grateful he was that the person had met his untimely death. And somehow I found myself spilling my secret to him. The first time I had ever told anyone what I could do. Amazingly, Van expressed no disbelief in my powers. Some traditions from his heritage and ancient culture conduced him to believe me. He asked me if I wanted a job. I'd never gone to college after high school. Although I was a smart kid, I found I just had no ambition, couldn't sustain any goals. I blamed that attitude on my powers. The arbitrary nature of death, and as exemplified by my own abilities, left me feeling that life could end at any time, and nothing was worth struggling for. So I told Van yes, I'd like a job. I became his secret hitman. I killed anyone who asked me to, mostly fellow criminals, but quite often not. The money was very, very good, and I lived a peaceful, satisfied life. No Dave ever uses my name when he hails me over the intercom. I suppose they're only following orders in this regard, too. Instead, they simply call out, "Attention!" Some Daves bark out the word as a command, while others are more polite, even saying, "Attention, please." The woman is one of the polite ones. Today, I'm reading when the call for attention sounds. It's one of the more brusquer Daves. I put down the book. It's a good book about a guy who's fed up with his life and moves to a little house in the country. Sounds like my situation, except I wasn't really fed up with my old life, and I didn't get to choose my retreat. The command for attention is followed by the instructions I've come to know so well. "There is a photo awaiting you in the door. Retrieve it and perform your standard function on the subject." "Sure thing, Dave," I reply. I go to the lone door in my apartment. Set midway in the door is a hinged panel. I pull down the panel and a receptacle big enough to hold a cafeteria tray piled with food is revealed. Of course, the far side of this space is blocked by another panel, this one locked. I often speculate about whether this delivery system is a box bolted to the outside of a normal door, or if the door itself is very thick, like one of those blast doors in a government bunker. This is how I get my magazines and fast food meals delivered, and also, of course, the photos of my victims. The photograph this time is generally similar to the majority of the other ones I've processed so far. It's a portrait of an Arabic-looking man, largish nose, wispy beard, disorderly black hair, fanatical eyes, grim mouth, an improbably jaunty scarf is tied around his neck. As usual, there's no information given as to his name, age, or nationality. His crimes are not detailed either. All that I need to know is that the people who control me want him dead. I take the photograph back to my comfortable recliner and go to work. Something about this victim's impregnable smugness, his air of righteous zealotry, irritates me, and I decide to go slow and be thorough. I imagine myself jamming the barrel of a pistol up his nostrils, shattering cartilage. I twist the gun cruelly before I blow the top of his head off, splattering the wall against which he's posed with his brains. I take an automatic rifle and use every bullet in the magazine to cut him literally in half. I duct tape several grenades to his crotch and pull the pins. I use a knife on his eyes and tongue before severing his jugular veins. And so on. At the end of 5 minutes, I'm quite sure that this man, wherever he is on the planet, is dead. One less terrorist to undermine global civilization. One less Chechen or Algerian or Taliban or Syrian. Or so I hope. I often wonder if there's anyone else with my powers. If such a being exists. Perhaps he or she is in the employ of rival powers, and one day my own photo will fall into their hands. This is a strangely comforting thought. Maybe you've read about that study which investigated the efficacy of prayers in the healing process. The researchers found out that patients who were prayed for by friends and relatives and who knew about the prayers healed faster. But then the experimenters went one step further. They got strangers to pray remotely for certain patients and never even told the patients who were getting such special attention. And the subjects still healed faster than average. That study seems to provide some sort of explanation for what I do. Except I don't say prayers, and I doubt the same God is answering mine. The way I found out about my power working on photographs of people, on shadows of their souls, as good as if I was standing right next to them, was like this. One day, when I was about 22, I was reading a newspaper and came across this article about a local drunken driver who'd wiped out a whole Asian family while they were crossing a street. He was one of those unrepentant types who refused even to admit that he was at fault, said something about the family jaywalking. I actually knew the people who got killed. They weren't close friends or relatives, but they ran a variety store in my neighborhood. I stopped in there a lot, and the owners were always nice to me. Learning how these people had died, I got so pissed off, and I started doing my thing on the newspaper photo of the drunken driver at his arrest. On the evening news, I heard that he had died in custody of natural causes. This was the mysteriously apt death I would discuss with Van Tran at the funeral for the store owners. Just like when I had first discovered my powers, I had to do a little experimenting with this new photo trick. I found out that any photo had to be no more than 24 hours old for me to succeed in killing the victim. Freshness counted. There must be something about a person's nature that continually changes with time and makes them a different person than what they were a day before, when they were earlier photographed. I don't like to use the word soul, but maybe that's the part that changes, gets updated with experience. Also, the image of the victim's face has to be highly detailed. Remote shots of little human smudges don't cut it. I wondered if television pictures would work as well. I tried, but the results were inconclusive. You know why? No single image stayed on the screen long enough for me to concentrate on. When's the last time you saw a person's face occupy the screen for 3 minutes without some kind of interruption, even if it's only a change in camera angles? And that was enough to reset my efforts to zero. But my captors must have thought there was a possibility I could do it, since they blocked the TV here from reception. I would have liked to see certain obnoxious TV personalities keel over live on camera, but I just never got the chance to make it happen. Of course, I sometimes wonder if I'm insane, or if I'm not alone in a padded cell hallucinating all this. But then I remember killing Tony Grasso, and all the killings that followed over the years in such clear and vivid detail that I'm again convinced of the reality of my present situation. And I don't believe that I could have come up with such a delusion on my own. Mutant soldier on the war on terrorism. Before my capture, I never gave two thoughts to the war on terror. Now, of course, it's with me all the time. 2 weeks after I killed the young Arab wearing the scarf, I got my usual delivery of delayed news magazines. My employer makes sure that the issues aren't current, just in case any photos were taken 24 hours before distribution. In the coverage of the Middle East, I saw pictures of a public funeral where my victim was the corpse. The text claimed that he was a mosque organizer who had been poisoned by infidels. Well, yes, I suppose so, after a fashion. I don't believe I've yet mentioned how long I've been doing this job, playing my part in the war on terror. Almost 3 years now. I was abducted in early 2002. Is my activity the reason why the United States has not experienced a domestic terror attack since September 11th? I like to think so, but I can't be sure. It's not as easy to get a suitable photo of a terrorist as you might imagine, but not as hard either. I keep waiting for a picture of Bin Laden, for instance, but it hasn't shown up yet. He must be hiding really well. Or maybe for some reason they don't want him dead yet. Generally speaking, if a Western operative can snap such a photo, they'd be in a position just to assassinate the guy outright, and they wouldn't need me. But lots of times, it seems, unwitting and greedy people close to the victim will provide a photo for money, thinking, what harm could it do? I am the answer to that question that they must never learn. Thinking about souls some more, I find additional comfort to support me in my work. If people do have souls, then I'm only liberating their essences from their imperfect shells, returning them to their source for another try at a better life, maybe. I think I read some similar philosophy once in a science fiction novel. It's good to be unemotional about what I do. Killing Tony Grasso was really the one and only time I felt pure hatred for any of my victims. After that, it was just always a job or an experiment. Between the ages of 13 and 22, I estimate that I caused the death of only about 50 people. That's only roughly 5 a year, a record that shows admirable restraint, I think. Even the terrorists don't push my buttons. I dislike what they're trying to do. Civilization doesn't need toppling, especially by jerks who offer only crude substitutes they intend to enact in its place. And I'm as patriotic as the next guy, so I'm pleased to be able to help my country. But all my killing is basically as simple to me as breathing. It's just something I do to stay alive. The photos come to me in random batches. No one can predict on any given day whether many terrorists or just a few will be careless enough to be photographed. Sometimes many days go by and I don't receive a single photo. Other times, I get three or more in the same day. After killing the terrorists with the scarf, I had a long break. I cooked elaborate meals, tossed darts, and read. I asked for extra DVDs. But then came a busy period. I had to kill two or three people a day. Strangulation, disembowelment, explosions, fall from great heights. My imagination really got a workout. And on that topic, I find that I need to envision new styles of death from time to time in order to keep my mind from wandering during the killing process. Luckily, the modern world offers no shortage of novel methods of dying. The news and entertainment media alone can keep me supplied with an endless flow of imagery to borrow. I do a lot of beheadings lately.
Attention! There's a photo awaiting you in the door. Retrieve it and perform your standard function on the subject.
After the busy period, this is the first call for my services in several days. Without any haste, I walk to the door and find the photo of my next victim. Surprisingly, the fellow is a middle-aged Caucasian man, European-looking. Not your usual terrorist. But then again, I've read the terrorists have been recruiting such types recently, converts to Islam mostly, to avoid being easily profiled. I have some vague memories of seeing his face before. He could be a terrorist sympathizer like John Walker Lind or that Australian guy held at Guantanamo. But in any case, my job is not to question why, but just to make him die. So I do, using several new methods I picked up from reading true crime accounts of serial killers. Sometimes I wonder if the non-rational, unscientific, mystical response that I represent to the war on terrorism was not inevitable. The rhetoric and actions of the terrorists are so archaic, so delusionary, so hallucinatory and superstitious that the only effective countermeasures must partake in the same qualities. One has to be a shadow boxer to fight shadows. Even if my powers were a lie, even if I were not killing anyone, perhaps the deliberately leaked news of my government-sanctioned existence would be an effective anti-terrorist weapon in itself. My regular delivery of news magazines stopped for 3 weeks. I asked the Daves why, but they wouldn't answer me. Of course, I immediately suspected that they were hiding something from me, but I wasn't clever enough to figure out what. Having this power of mine was not really such a big deal in the end. I couldn't use it to become fabulously rich or to rule the world. At least I couldn't figure out any way to accomplish those things. All it did was earn me an upper-middle-class income without much exertion. Then it got me locked up in here. I'm forced to conclude that killing people, even remotely without laying a hand on them, is just not very useful or creative. It's an activity with limited potential for payback. The Dave who summons me today is the somewhat friendly woman, and she sounds unusually nervous. I've never heard any of the Daves sound uncertain of themselves before. Attention, please. You have, new reading material awaiting you. From the door, I bring back to my chair an issue of Time magazine from 3 weeks ago. Inside, I learn the identity of my Caucasian victim, the Canadian Prime Minister. This is what they've been hiding from me. Oh, I should have remembered his face. I study the news religiously. But who could remember such a bland, innocuous Canadian face? I trigger the intercom. Who are you? Why have you chosen to show me this now? But there's no answer. The Canadian Prime Minister. The Canadian Prime Minister I knew did not see eye to eye with the President on foreign policy. It seems the definition of enemies in the war on terror has broadened. I wish I'd studied more about history instead of math and science. Is this treachery among allies just part of the game of global politics? Is a move like this demanded by the harsh, unrelenting times we live in? What should I do if ordered again to kill another player from our side? My native intelligence and haphazard self-instruction only stretches so far. I wish now I had never discovered my powers. Never killed Tony Grasso or all the others. But I suppose it's much too late for that. I'm pretty certain it's the same woman who summons me the next day over the intercom. I can't think of her as Dave any longer, and would like to know her real name, but I don't dare ask. Astonishingly, she asks me a question. Attention, please. We know you read the magazine. Do you still want to continue to help us set things right? Something in the tone of her voice compels me to say, "Yes, yes, I do." She sounds relieved. "Very well." She reverts to the formula as if finding comfort in the rigid protocol. "There is a photo awaiting you in the door. Retrieve it and perform your standard function on the subject." With some eagerness, I snatch the photograph from the slot. It's a picture of the president. But there's something else accompanying it. A gift. A hand mirror. Small, like a woman would carry in her purse, but big enough for the task. I really wish I could be sure about souls.
And that was our story. Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. All other rights are reserved by our authors. If you liked this week's story, please tell a friend or blog about us. You can also leave us comments on our website, escapepod.org, or via email or voicemail. See the Contact Us link on our site. Our opening music is by permission of Daikaiju at daikaiju.org. Our special closing song is You Be King by Andy Guthrie, with permission via the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Check out his album, Milk and Waste. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Have fun.
It shuns and goes in confessions and lines with rings and drapples. Black water to bathe all the lepers. Broken promise given from foes. You'll be king and we'll be all your slaves. You break backs and we'll submit and praise. Undressing with wine, in walks the truth. Red faces swollen with dirt, keep them buried, the blood and their worth. As Jesus was condemned, those that praise him still do turn your back on a world if they live not as you. Evil chokes on its own dressing as it bites, spits more than it chews. Can't were to be blessings and evil overrode, then greed would not be envied as love shall not be cruel. Oh, it shines now in prisms and bathes in clear pools. What first had it taught us? It taught us in rules evil chose on its own dressing as it bites, spits. Put me on trial, put me to death.